From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Welcome to ARRL's The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, I'm going to ask you a question that I think I've asked you, what, a dozen times over the last...
Week.
Well, I've always pestered you about whether or not any given antenna I'm playing with is high enough. I'm obsessed with that because 50 feet's about as high as I can get in my property. And is that enough? I mean, I know it varies for a given antenna and so on, but I hear that a lot, and not just for me, but for many other people. How high is high enough?
Well, that's a good question. And there's also how high is too high. You have to.
Well, yeah.
I mean, and it depends very much on the band and the kind of antenna and so forth. And if you're 50 feet, I suggest don't forget to keep watering your trees and feeding your trees because it'll be, you know, maybe next year it'll be 52 feet.
So well, I can't wait that long. Really.
Anyway, there are a number of different things. We might want to divide it up. First thing to consider is VHF FM, which is probably the kind of communication most hams start with. And that's perhaps the easiest to discuss because most VHF FM communication is essentially line of sight. We call it LOS, which is abbreviation for line of sight. So you'll see LOS a lot, and that's what they're talking about. Now, this means that your antenna needs to be high enough so that your antenna has a relatively clear path to the desired destination, whether it's a repeater or another fixed station or a mobile station that's driving by. And the interesting thing about that is that this often has more to do with the terrain around both stations than it does about how high the antenna is above your ground. So if you have even a very high antenna and there's a mountain in between you, it's not going to matter much. So the mountain is the limiting factor. Now, one thing to bear in mind is the LOS path is actually a little bit longer than the application of trig with your dimensions and so forth, what might suggest, because the electromagnetic radiation is refracted by the atmosphere. And what happens is that can be kind of approximated by assuming that the Earth is actually 4/3 of its diameter, so a little flatter than it actually is geometrically. That's something radar engineers think about a lot. Now, this is most important in areas in which there are few obstructions, because the obstructions tend to make the other parts of the equation less important. And in some parts of the country, you have hilly terrain, and that's going to define your communications path length. In other parts, you have flat terrain, and then the antenna height has a direct relation to the distance to the horizon. So basically what you do is you have two stations talking to each other, whether one's a repeater or two stations of any kind. And what you essentially have, if you are limited by path length, is you each have a path length to your horizon. And the sum of the two distances to the horizon is essentially the path length. You have to have a little above the horizon because the signal requires a little space off the ground, you know, half wavelength or so at least. But that's a very easy way to figure it out. You can figure those out geometrically. And having done that, to a horizon, assuming a flat terrain, you go down to your town engineer's office or bookstore or someplace and get a topographical map and find out what the elevation of the Earth is in between, and you can see if that is going to impact your line of sight path to the horizon. And that'll tell you the whole story for that. Now, the other thing that we do with VHF, or many do, is communicate through to low-orbit satellites.
Yes.
And some of those are for FM. They work just like repeaters that are moving overhead. We're still limited by line-of-sight path, but if the satellite is overhead, pretty much we have a line-of-sight path to the satellite, as long as you're not in something, a large metal building or something.
Yes.
Now, the importance of the height and the terrain then becomes a question of at what point do you first see the satellite. The higher you are and the lower the obstructions are around you, the earlier you'll be able to acquire the satellite and the longer you'll be able to communicate through it before it disappears behind the hill or past the horizon. Now, VHF communication via other modes, single sideband, CW, or digital modes, is still mainly a line-of-sight business, except its far end is more variable. In that case, we're looking for longer distances, and oftentimes we're looking for direct station-to-station communications, often as far as we can get, and the higher antenna makes much more difference. But there's no particular magic height. And again, it's a combination of the height of your station and the height of the other stations. And I have a very limited VHF station. I have a 35-foot high four-element Yagi on 2 meters, for example. By itself, or to talk to another similar station, I might be able to get 30 miles or so. But every now and then during a contest, which is kind of interesting, you run into somebody from 300 miles away who's got a 150-foot tower, a giant Yagi, and running legal limit, and they pull the weight, and we can actually make contact. So that's very straightforward extension of the line of sight to take advantage of their line of sight to their horizon, even though your station isn't equipped to do so much by itself. But there are other modes, too. Sporadic propagation via the E-layer is very common on 10 and 6 meters, and that doesn't require high antennas because that's at relatively high angles. But higher antennas will get you to E-layer clouds that are further away.
I've noticed that myself, yes.
But even if you have a quite low antenna on 6 meters, if there's sporadic e-propagation happening, you'll make contacts to the Midwest or from Connecticut or sometimes even to the West Coast.
Oh, you bet. I've done it with a 6-meter dipole in my attic one time, so yeah.
So there's no minimum height that you need. I mean, the higher the better on FM or on VHF generally, but don't give up the ship just because you can't have a really high antenna.
Before we get to HF, which I have a feeling is where you're headed here.
That is.
Why don't we take a break and we'll hear from DX Engineering.
Okay.
All right.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel.
Very good.
Now let's talk HF.
Okay.
HF antennas.
HF is the somewhat more complicated antenna height question, and it has a lot of different answers depending on what you want to do. So if you're looking for long-distance contacts via the F-layer, ionospheric propagation, the higher your horizontal antenna is above ground, the lower the angle your signal will leave the antenna, resulting in a longer path to the F-layer, which gives you a longer path on a single hop. And that's very important. Now, the usual rule of thumb to get a reasonably good performance on HF, in my opinion, is the antenna wants to be at least a half wave above, a horizontal antenna wants to be at least a half wave above ground, and higher up to three-quarter or even a full wavelength above ground is good. Now, notice that depends on what band. So on a half wave on 20 meters is about 35 feet, coincidentally where my tri-bander is. But that same height is a full wavelength at 10 meters. So it's going to be different on each band. You could take advantage of that depending on what bands are open. Unfortunately, the higher bands are not open as much as they used to be, but from time to time they are.
But on 80 meters, you're telling me 60-some-odd feet or more, I can't get my antenna that high.
That's a quarter wavelength. It has to be twice that.
Twice that. Oh, good.
130 feet. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely right. And what happens is the other side of the coin is if you can't have a horizontal antenna at least half a wavelength high and you want to work DX, you probably will have better results with a vertical monopole. It could even be on the ground. So the bottom of it has zero height. Of course, the top is probably close to a quarter wavelength, or it can be loaded or shortened for many ways.
Well, I was about to ask you. In other words, if somebody wants to put up a horizontal antenna, and they can't get it for 80 meters, and they can't get it 130-some-odd feet in the air, should they just give up?
No, absolutely not. They should. Well, first of all, depends on who you want to talk to. You could put that 80-meter antenna 25 feet off the ground, and your radiation will go more or less upwards, which will not do very well for DX, although there will be some radiation at low angles, but most of the antenna radiation will be upwards. And what that'll do is that will refract from the same F-layer that's right above you and give you good, solid communication for a range of a few hundred miles to somebody else who's so equipped. And that kind of communication you basically can't do with a vertical antenna, because a vertical antenna will have no radiation going straight up, generally, unless it's tilted somewhat. So, again, there's no minimum height. It depends on who you want to talk to. And if you want to talk, if you have that antenna that's 25 feet high and you use it on all bands, expect to use it for local communication on 80 and 40 meters, and probably 20 as well. And on the higher bands, it'll start to become high enough that you'll get significant low-angle radiation. So when those bands start to get open again, it'll work well for long-distance communication. So it all depends on the frequency, and it depends on who you want to talk to. So if you want to talk long distances and you typically want to be up at half a wavelength or higher with a horizontal antenna. Now, how high is too high? That's an interesting question, too, because as you get much above 3/4 of a wavelength, you start getting a lot of nulls in your pattern in terms of the vertical angle. So it may be, you know, your first lobe will be at a very low angle, which is very good for very long distance communication. But if you're trying to talk to somebody from the East Coast, you're trying to work into Europe, maybe you don't need to be quite that low. And it might be that the station you want to work ends up in one of the nulls.
Yes.
In between the lobes of your pattern. So you get a complicated pattern starting at, you know, about a wavelength high, I think. So the real serious HF operators, if we look at the big contest stations, will typically have multiple horizontal antennas at different heights that they can either select which one to use depending on the elevation angle they want, or they can feed them in phase to have a mid-level signal that's even stronger at a particular angle, or they can feed them out of phase and have them go high to get a high angle radiation kind of thing. And most of us probably can't do that very easily, but because you have to have a pretty high tower to have three or four 20-meter or 40-meter Yagis at reasonable height. But I've seen some stations like that, and it's quite impressive. But for most of us, if you have an antenna in the range of at least a half wavelength, a horizontal antenna within at least a half wavelength, and no more than a lot, you know, around a wavelength, you will have very good coverage for most DX kind of thing, kind of a compromised situation. So on the low range of that frequency range, like 20 meters on my tri-bander, it's a little low for real long range stuff, but it still has a fairly continuous elevation pattern that will get me the medium range stations nicely. And then on the higher frequencies, it'll do even better. So there's no magic single number that works for everybody for everything, and any antenna you put up will radiate somewhere, and there's always somebody to talk to.
There's or if you must have a horizontal antenna, put it up as high as you can get it reasonably.
That's right,
and you will make contacts.
That's right, and if you can't get it high enough to do what you want, look into vertical antennas. Now, horizontal antennas have a inherent 6 dB roughly advantage due to ground reflection gain for low angle signals at the angle that they support. You know, if the antenna is very low, that signal is going to be going upwards. And that's, you know, good for certain kinds of things, but not good for long distance work. So if you can do a horizontal antenna, you'll be at the appropriate height, you'll do better than you will with a vertical. But if you can't do the horizontal, the vertical is going to be better than the low horizontal generally for long distance work.
Well, Joel, we have a question from Larry, K7EKD. And he's asking, how do I determine the total intermodulation distortion, or IMD, output of a cascaded transceiver and amplifier? For example, if I have a transceiver with a third-order IMD of minus 31 dB and run it through a power amp that has a third-order IMD of minus 35 dB, how would I calculate the total third-order IMD of the signal output?
That's a good question. And the straightforward answer is that you first determine the level of the intermod products coming from your transceiver. For the case of a 100-watt output transceiver in your example, minus 31 dB would be about 0.08 watts of IMD, third-order IMD, coming out of the transmitter. Now, these products enter your amplifier just like your signal, and get amplified by the same amount. And let's say you had a 10 dB gain, well, that, which would be the case for a kilowatt amplifier driven by 100 watts. So your 0.08 watts in becomes 0.8 watts IMD coming out from the contribution of the transceiver. Now, the amplifier would contribute its own IMD at minus 35 dB in your example, and that's below the 1 kilowatt signal that you have, so that would be about 0.32 watts of power from that. So what you have is two components of your IMD. They may not be of the same phase. If they're not of the same phase, they won't add to the sum of the two. But the worst case would be if they were the same phase, and then it would just be the arithmetic sum, which would be 1.12 watts or minus 29.5 dB. That's fairly typical. That's the answer to your direct question, but there's something else you could think about. The transmit IMD measurements of transceivers that you look at in product reviews in QST, based on lab data from the ARL lab, are generally conducted at full rated power. That's typically 100 watts output. And there are some amplifiers, like grounded grid amplifiers, that need that much drive, but most modern amplifiers, both vacuum tube and transistors, can operate with much less drive. The thing about the 100-watt solid-state transceivers that we use that are running on 13.8 volts is they tend to be somewhat high in IMD compared to what they would be if they were running less power. So what happens now, if you have a, if you only need to drive the final amplifier with, say, 25 watts from your transceiver, crank down the transceiver, the IMD will go down significantly, much more than just the change in power. So the chances are that with most solid-state transceivers, cranking back the power will make it such that the major contribution to the IMD is that occurs actually in the linear amplifier itself. So what will happen is that the IMD will always be a little bit worse than the worst of the two in the cascaded case. If they were both the same, roughly the IMD goes up by up to 3 dB if they're adding in phase. But if one of them is significantly less than the other, it's just going to be slightly worse than the worst one. So if you're running your transceiver at a low power, chances are the actual IMD will be very close to that of the linear. That doesn't always work, but that's just the way it works out. So that may be the case, depending on what kind of amplifier you're using and what kind of how hard you have to drive it.
That's a very good explanation, Joel. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.